5-4-3. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Greg Rucka. Greg, welcome back to KBOO.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
I think I need to... Yeah, there we go. Now I can... Now they can hear me, besides me hearing me. The title of your latest book is A Gentleman's Game, published by Bantam. How long have you been involved with the comic book world? Let me start with that, because that's fairly fresh in my mind.
I started doing comics with a company here in Portland, Oni Press. I think would have been 98 now. And I did a murder mystery with them. It was drawn by a fabulous artist named Steve Lieber, who's also local, called Whiteout. And it was essentially a Lost Continent mystery. It's set in Antarctica, and it's about... A U.S. deputy marshal is stationed at McMurdo, who's one of the only women in Antarctica, and she ends up with a corpse and has to solve it. And it was a fabulous experience, because at that point I had three novels out and had wanted to go into comics for a while just to explore the form.
We have to call them graphic novels now because...
Oh, yes, because comics are a dirty word.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Yeah. So, were you a fan of those things before you started writing for them?
Yeah, I started... it's funny because I try to remember what was the first comic book. I have an older sister who has Down syndrome. Hmm. And growing up, she was in love with Bill Bixby as the Incredible Hulk and Lou Ferrigno. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense, because here's this guy who is smart and kind and gentle, and if you're ever threatened, he turns into this 6.5 foot tall, muscle-bound monster that will defeat the bad guys but never harm the good guys. And I remember being, I think, 10 and out with her and going into a shop in my hometown of Monterey at that point.
Why, you grew up in Monterey?
Yeah.
Lucky boy.
Yeah, not bad. I mean, growing up Steinbeck country, and yeah, yeah. I got to hang out on Cannery Row with my miscreant friends and all those good things. Yeah. But I went into this comic book store, and at that point, Marvel was putting out a Hulk magazine, I guess, to capitalize on the TV show. And I actually tracked down a copy of this a little while ago just to see if my memory served. And it was the Hulk versus 3 Mile Island, basically. It was the Hulk versus the nuclear reactors. And I just remember there being this big double-page spread, you know, 2 pages of art where the Hulk is, like, in the reactor core trying to hold up the control rod so they won't crash in. And I don't remember how he got out of it. But I remember being just fascinated by the color, in particular the richness of it, and trying to draw. Taking it to school with me and having it taken away from me, because I would sit at my desk trying to copy these panels. And I have no visual artistic ability whatsoever. So
Yeah.
And that lasted, you know, I went into high school and I fell in with a group of like-minded comic book fans. And when you have peers, you all start sharing stuff around. So that was really a broad exposure. And I came in at that point at a really good time, because there was a renaissance going on in the comic book industry. We had writers like Alan Moore and Frank Miller who were doing things that people just had never seen before, or had seen before but never done as skillfully. You know, Miller is a noir writer, and he had done a Batman story called The Dark Knight Returns, and it is the most hard-boiled prose. He uses a first-person narrative for Batman / Bruce Wayne, and it is so hard-boiled, the yolk is green. I mean, it is just, you know, icy needles of pain shoot into my face kind of narrative.
Yeah, right.
And I remember moving from that and being, and it's very over the top, and finding an earlier work he had done for Marvel with the character Daredevil. And the art there was by a guy named David Mazzucchelli, and Miller's prose, perfect marriage. I mean, and comics at their best, are more than a sum of their parts. Unlike, say, working in a novel, because a novel is pretty much an isolated endeavor. But comics require collaboration, and when the collaboration works, you really, really can make some magic. And this story, I remember, was magical. And I remember that being the watershed moment. They weren't comics, because I was a sophisticated reader at that point. I was 15 or 16, and I was precocious and reading everything that I shouldn't and things like that. And I remember reading it and being like, this is different. This proves how wrong everybody is when they say comics are just simple, they're just for kids or whatnot. Of course they're entertaining, but they have the capacity to be as moving and as profoundly affecting as any good piece of art.
Mm-hmm. Well, Art Spiegelman certainly changed everybody's head with Mouse.
Now in The Shadow of No Towers.
Right. So. I was a kid in the first golden age of comics, and I used to collect Batman and Captain Marvel, and I especially liked Plastic Man and The Spirit. You know, when I saw a reissue of the Spirit comics, I bought them immediately. Yeah. So.
They now do, DC publishes these lovely hardcover volumes called the Spirit Archives.
Really?
And they're reprinting like all of Eisner's Spirit runs. Well,
see, now I'm going to have to lose more of my money on this.
Yeah, stuff. I got to tell you, it is a dangerous, dangerous addiction.
Okay, well, this discussion of comics is not without any meaning at all, because the character here, Tara Chase, did she start out as a comic book character?
Yeah, Tara is actually the main character in an ongoing comic book series called Queen and Country, which is also published by Oni Press. And the actual full title for the novel is A Gentleman's Game, a Queen and Country novel. So Tara existed, or came into existence in comics. She is a spy. And this is done as realistically as possible, given the confines of fiction. But she is, for lack of a better phrase, a real-world James Bond. She is the head agent in a group of three agents that work for Her Majesty's Secret Intelligence Service. And these are the special operations officers. These are the people that the government tasks to do the very ugly jobs that need to be done quickly and efficiently, and
they call it wet work in CIA.
Yeah, I mean, and not, you know, it's not necessarily put bullet A into person B, but it can be anything from, you know, we've lost these documents in Hong Kong, they need to be found in 36 hours, or we have this problem, go and get them and make sure it's hushed up. Or we've had a walk-in, you know, who wants to defect, go evaluate and then determine if you're keeping, you know, if this is somebody you want to bring over, boomerang them back to the other side or whatnot. So the series is now at issue 27. Issue 27 came out a couple weeks ago. And you are limited in comics as you are limited in novels. You know, I mean, everything, every form has its strengths and its weaknesses. And one of the things that the comics really hadn't allowed was for a long sort of analysis of Tara and other characters around her, her immediate supervisors, a incredible piece of work by the name of Paul Crocker, for instance, and I hadn't gotten to spend a lot of time on him. So,
you anticipated my question as well. Yeah. Having written 26 editions of a graphic novel,
yeah,
and now a word novel,
yeah,
how did you have to change your head, or what did it free you in a way? What did you find it more limiting than to work with a comic artist?
It was exceptionally rewarding, ultimately. It was very hard to start because I had to keep reminding myself that just because I was so familiar with all these people and I knew all these things, I had to make sure that it was clear in the prose. And the novel itself was sort of an interesting challenge because it really served, I wanted it to serve two masters. There are some very, very passionate fans for the comic book series, but the series isn't terribly well read and it's not terribly easy to find. It's a black and white comic book for mature readers published by a small publisher. This isn't something that you find racked next to the latest issue of Batman, for instance.
More's the pity, eh?
Yeah. You know, well, we're getting more exposure and that's good, but one of the things I wanted was then, if I was going to devote the time to a novel, I wanted to make sure that I wrote a novel that fans of the series would find rewarding, that wouldn't be a retread. But at the same time, I needed to make certain that I was writing a novel that people who had never heard of the series wouldn't be lost by. At the start, that proved the biggest mental hurdle. That, and also this is only the second published novel I've done that's been written in third person. Most of the stuff I've done has been, I guess, strictly PI genre. And as such, I like writing first person.
Yeah, but third person really has its advantages. And well, you can get inside here, people's heads. You can be in two places at the same time. Yeah.
Well, and here it was crucial. And trying to do multiple first persons would have just been very confusing. So once I sort of broke in, I had to rediscover those muscles. So once those were broken in and the lactic acid sort of eased back into the rest of the system, it wrote very well. I mean, it was a very different experience writing this novel.
Do you think it's going to feed back in some way into your comic book writing?
I think it already has. It's interesting because I do view the novel as part of the overall series. Mm-hmm. I don't look at it and go, okay, Queen and Country comics are one thing and then the novel is something else. So ideally you read the novel and then you go and you pick up issue 29 of Queen and Country and you can, I mean, issue 29, the events of the novel influence what happens next in the series. It's all part of one whole.
Let me ask a question. When the Soviet Union came to ruin and modern Russia, quote unquote, was born, a lot of people said, well, there goes the spy novel because we have lost the great Satan. We've lost the opponent, you know, the thing that drove. I mean, you can go back to the Nazis, I suppose, and you can go back to the Revolutionary War.
Well, and that's why there were, for a while, this gap in espionage where everybody was writing historical espionage. And all of a sudden it was people running around Berlin, you know, in the shadow of Kristallnacht. Exactly.
So everybody thought that the main engine of the 20th century spy novel was gone.
Yeah.
But in fact, we have yet another opponent.
Well,
now.
I mean, it's a two-pronged answer, actually, because the key event in the novel, A Gentleman's Game, starts with a terrorist event, and it's a strike in London, and the novel is about, initially, how the British government feels they must retaliate, and their decision to retaliate, and the form that retaliation takes, and then how Chase is tasked with implementing it. You know, for I'm sure there are lots of writers out there who are very grateful that we now have a new big bad guy to fight.
Much more amorphous. Moscow to hit.
Exactly, and we can go wherever we want. Right. And dramatically, I see the appeal there. But the argument that after the Cold War ended, that the espionage stories were done, that you can only tell now historical espionage, was just utter garbage. It's not true. And anybody who thinks that the CIA was sitting around sucking its thumb between, say, the fall of the Berlin Wall or actually 91 and the hardline coup failing in Moscow and, say, 2001 September, they're just not paying attention. I mean,
I heard they were sucking somebody else's thumb.
They've been sucking a lot of things, actually.
wait, before we go on, let me remind... This is the right station to say that.
Okay.
Before we go on, let me remind our listeners, talking to Greg Rucka, and Greg is, you're a Portlander, and this is his latest novel, A Gentleman's Game, published by Bantam. I see a lot of research in this. Now, I guess the question, I don't know much about the spy genre except what I read in books and the newspapers. So I know about MI5 and MI6.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't even know if those distinctions still are valid distinctions.
They're used. My understanding is that they're actually fictional, but they are used.
Uh-huh.
We refer to the British Exterior Security Agency, the spy company, as MI6.
Right, an internal...
Is MI5.
Sort of like their FBI, in effect.
Yeah, kind of. They're called the security services.
Right. Now, did you steep yourself in the lore? I mean, there's this scene set in Cairo, this scene set in European cities.
Yeah.
Did you go to these places?
No. I went to London. I do as much research as I possibly can get away with.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's impractical.
It would have been so cool to do the tour on this book.
I would have loved to have gone to Sana'a, but you know, I'm a middle class white Jewish guy from Portland. The odds of getting a look inside the Great Mosque in Sana'a are pretty low.
The odds of getting out of Sana'a once you got in are also pretty low.
Yeah, that's a separate discussion. So, I did a lot of research online. I'm very careful in my research. I always want two sources. And I always look very carefully where the information is coming from. And then I use, and this is like giving away my biggest secret.
You don't have to if you don't want
to. I feel it's actually, they deserve the press. Lonely Planet guidebooks are the greatest research tool for a writer who needs to write a place that they cannot get to or will never be able to go. And they have a guidebook for just about anywhere. And they're beautifully, brilliantly written because they're not, you know, they're not Frommer's Guide to Sanaa. It's not, this hotel has great
Rick
food.
Steve's even worse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You get wonderful overviews of the society, of the culture, of the history of the place, of the people. And then you get really a fairly up-to-date on-the-ground feel. So, again, you know, there are whole sections of Sanaa, you know, where Chase is in Yemen, in the old market, in the old city in Sanaa. And I was able to write that fairly convincingly. It may all be wrong. It may turn out that, you know, my sources on this information are incorrect.
Great chain yank is happening here. But
exactly. The, but man, it looks believable, doesn't it? The verisimilitude.
Sucked me in. So. The other thing about it is spycraft. Now, the thing about this, we were talking before we went on recording that you plot well. I have very great difficulty plotting. I'm not a subtle person by nature, and twists and turns and double crosses, which is really what spy novels are all about. I mean, John le Carré and all those guys could write great double crosses and great leaving people out in the cold and, and sacrificing them
moral,
to the cause.
The moral bankruptcy is, I think, the hallmark of the modern...
a moral cesspool, as Lenny Bruce
exactly.
called it, yeah.
I mean, I think A Gentleman's Game is very, very subversive. I think that there are people who are going to read it and think it is a jingoistic endorsement of the global war on terror.
Gee, I didn't feel that way at all.
I think that... you're probably a fairly astute reader. I'm sure there are people out there who are gonna read it at face value. And,
well, it's a genre novel. If you know if you're reading a romance novel, you don't expect that all relationships work out that way.
Yeah.
So you're in spy novel world. When you're in spy novel world, you have to go by their.
Well, and we wanted to ask. You know, I sat down and I talked to my agent for a while before working on it, and the question I wanted to ask myself. And I have a friend who's in the State Department, and he and I talked about this as well, which is at what point does the moral reprehensibility scale get, you know, out of whack? What is more morally reprehensible? Is it killing 372 people in the London Underground, or is it murdering two men as they're praying in a mosque? You know, and you can't make that comparison, because the second you're talking about that kind of action, you've just acknowledged the whole horror of all of it.
It's a matter of scale. That's
exactly it.
Yeah.
And you are now, as we are in the world, I think, in a cycle of murder begetting murder. We're just going to, you know, and we all know the inevitable end of that is you do that until there's nobody left or until somebody comes to their senses.
Yeah. Well, if you look at Israel and Palestine, if you can't figure it out from looking at that, there's no hope for you, is there?
No.
Let's talk a little bit about the book. Tara, she's interesting because she's a woman, and she's in, quote-unquote, a man's job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because of that, she has to do everything backwards and in high heels, right?
Yeah.
So, but she's good at what she does.
Yeah.
But it takes its price on her. Why don't you describe Tara for us a little bit?
She's, I tend to write about protagonists who... are sort of at odds with themselves. There's always a nature versus nurture issue. And Tara comes from a background where she really should be happily married and running with the Sloan Rangers and having a husband who is, you know, providing very well for her. And for whatever reason, rejected all of that and not only went into a job that is not an easy job, but went into then one of the more difficult aspects of the job and pursues it with abandon.
For our listeners who may not know, the Sloan Rangers are a bunch of rich layabouts, the crowd from which Princess Diana emerged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tara has issues. I mean, Tara has issues, and one of the issues is that she needs to prove herself to herself over and over again.
I love that she was a slob and her place is a total mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think one of my favorite descriptions, and it's early on, is she's just, you know, you get the description of her apartment and how and this is true, most people who are in special operations, if you talk to Green Berets or people like that, they tend to have hobbies that they are very focused on. They build ships in bottles like nobody's business. They build these ships, the best ships, in the smallest bottles, and that's the thing they do when they're not doing everything else that they have to do. You know, so one of the people that she works with, you know, is passionate about a certain make and model of a car. Another guy collected motorcycles. Another guy was a chef. And in the narrative, it talks about the fact that Tara never had, for instance, a hobby that she pursued to let herself
smoking
relax.
Smoking and drinking.
Yeah, well, and then the ones that are cited are smoking, drinking, and sex.
Yeah.
And the description of that is, you know, with... She pursued all three with the same abandon as the guys who do the cars and so on, but without the rewards to show for it.
Can't have sex in a bottle.
No. So it's you know, it's, the moment there is that I think there was a description about how she eats, you know, she has no interest in cooking, and when she eats, she's eating takeaway, and normally she's eating it over the sink. And it is indicative. She doesn't care about her home life. That's not who she is. Her house is not who she is.
She eats to live rather than lives to eat, yeah. I believe, is the cliche.
That's
about
exactly.
That. Yeah. Now, she works with this guy, Paul Crocker, whom you mentioned before.
Yeah. He's a piece of work too. Anyway.
Well, you know, he's a product of of the organization in which he has arisen.
Yeah.
I guess the point I was trying to make here is that the infighting within the British Secret Services, mm-hmm. and the kind of love-hate relationship they have with the Central Intelligence Agency, mm-hmm. I'm wondering how much of that is true, or is it just one of those street stories?
The people I've talked to say right now. I mean, at this moment in this historical moment in time, or at least about a year and a half ago, there was really no friction going on. The friction that I'm describing between the agencies, meaning between SIS and the CIA, is probably more a product of the late Cold War. However, I'm working on the second novel in this series right now, and it's set in Uzbekistan. And the UK just recalled their ambassador from Uzbekistan and axed him. He has been relieved of his post. The ambassador's name is Craig Murray, and Craig has been speaking out since May on the fact that Uzbekistan has one of the worst human rights records in the world. They routinely execute and torture people to death. And that his latest comments were that the Uzbeki security forces are torturing people to obtain intelligence information that is false, that is then being passed on to SIS and CIA. And for saying this, he lost his job.
Mm-hmm.
I have no doubt he's telling the absolute truth.
I have two words, Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's no question.
Maybe that's one
there word. There is obviously, you know, to imply that in any organization, everybody is walking lockstep in one direction is most likely false, but more to the point is anti-dramatic. And one of the things that I wanted to do in an espionage novel, and especially in this one, in A Gentleman's Game, was to say no espionage decision is made on the basis of espionage. It's not even made on the basis of security. It's made on the basis of politics. Politics rules the roost. We do what is politically viable, politically necessary, and more often than not, that is in direct conflict with what is the best thing to do, either for our protection or morally or ethically. They do not coexist easily.
So this is the idea that for political reasons, one cherry picks the information one wants and mm-hmm. ignores the rest. Sometimes to one's detriment.
Yeah, and that's not actually unique.
Never is. It's not unique in university research.
Right, and it's been going on forever. So that, and I do think if there's one thing that differentiates, if there's only one thing that differentiates A Gentleman's Game from, say, the rest of the genre, it is that attention to the internal politics, that there is a constant fight going on in SIS, you know, where Crocker is trying to protect Tara and the agents like her while trying to serve his masters. And his masters ultimately, you know, at the top of the chain is the prime minister, is a guy who he's never met and who has never met Chase. there is a point in every organization, you know, large organizations, especially in the government, the U.S. does this all the time. The institution is more important than the individual. And the Army certainly believes that. That's a military, it's an operating military premise, because you can't engage in combat otherwise. You cannot sacrifice soldiers if you say that this guy is more important than the rest. And it gets them into trouble on occasion, but at the same time, the alternative gets them into trouble. You look at, say, Black Hawk Down. The whole idea of the story is that we have a unit that's whole credo is we don't leave anybody behind. Back in the State Department, when that was going on, back at the Pentagon, back at the White House, they would have liked nothing more for them to have just been like, you leave him behind. Mm-hmm. Leave him behind. It costs so much less to leave him behind. Just a little bit of your soul. That's all you have to do. But we don't have to kill all these guys, and we don't have to get in the morass, and we don't have to get into the political fallout of this. But the ethos of the unit is one that doesn't allow for it. That's a rare instance where that attitude is allowed to exist and persist.
I have a this is kind of a dumb question. I hope you'll bear with me. They say that science fiction is a way to criticize what's going on now by putting it in a distant future or in another galaxy.
Yeah.
Are you doing the same thing with your spy novels?
Yeah. I come, you know, this is my first espionage novel. Prior to it, I've written some six what would be called PI novels or novels of that genre. And I came to the Private Investigator novel because it was a form of social commentary, as far as I'm concerned.
So your ideas haven't changed with this
no,
one?
No. I mean, and I'm not about to stop. I think it's incumbent upon every writer. Every writer's political, whether they want to be or not. Every writer's giving commentary, whether they want to or not, because we all make choices in what we put down on the page. I mean, you know that.
Yeah.
And the second you start making those choices, you're making decisions and you're promoting an agenda. I don't ever write polemics because polemics, one, they're not entertaining, and you're not really going to convince anybody by shouting at them. I think what a gentleman's game is it's a damn good spy story.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, and it's got in it some things that hopefully you walk away and you think about and you go like, wow, what a mess.
Yeah. Kinky Friedman once said that people are always finding more in my books than I'm putting into them. So maybe that's...
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'd like to say once more time, first of all, Greg, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I've been speaking with Greg Rucka. Greg is the author of A Gentleman's Game and several other novels, actually, at this point.
Yeah.
And this one is published by Bantam. Come again with the new Tara Chase novel.
Absolutely will. Thanks
a lot.